You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North, and for the first time in quite some time...
me, Edward Gomez.
So welcome back, Edward, after 8 months away from the podcast. So it's been... the world has had an interesting 8 months, but there's been a lot going on in the astronomy world as well.
Yes, thank you for carrying on without me.
We've muddled through. There's been a lot to talk about. Let's talk this month about the stuff that's happened in the previous few weeks. So we're recording this just towards the end of October, and a few days ago, before we recorded, there was a first for NASA, not necessarily a first for the world, but a first for NASA, which was touching down and landing and collecting samples from an asteroid. And this is the OSIRIS-REx mission that went to the asteroid Bennu. And this is, collecting these samples is really important for understanding these asteroids in more detail, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And there's... you can study asteroids in a variety of different ways, and comets and things like that. And missions like the Rosetta mission that launched a probe onto the surface of a comet had a chemistry set on board, which they used for analyzing the comet. But in this case, this is a package up and return to sender, if you like, mission. So OSIRIS-REx did a high five, collected some samples from this asteroid Bennu, and is going to return sometime in 2023, I think, to the lab. And obviously then you can, if you have enough samples, then you're not limited by what you can carry. You can bring this material back to Earth and do a much larger range of tests to assess things like the water content, the makeup of the soil. It's we call it regolith because soil is really the surface of the Earth, whereas regolith is the surface of other bodies. So you know what the chemical composition is of that, and you can do a much better job of it on Earth, but you can also contaminate your sample as well. So you have to take extremely careful steps to make sure that sample is returned to Earth as pristine as it was on the asteroid.
Yeah, you don't just stick it in a bit of Tupperware and go and take it to the lab. It's packaged.
Yeah, that's right.
Vacuums. Well, it's already in a vacuum because it's in space, and
yep,
it's dealt with very, very, very carefully. You're right. You can do an awful lot more on Earth than you can on the asteroid, with the most sophisticated chemistry experiments and so on that can be taken on spacecraft, but the ability to bring it back to Earth is crucial. But you are then, what you can't do is, it's a one-shot mission because it's gone to this asteroid, it's lowered itself down. I mean, there are videos online showing this very fast collision and so on. Actually, they're all time lapses. This thing approached at something like 10 centimeters a second, I think, touched down for 6 seconds and then backed off a bit more quickly. And in the meantime, it blow a jet of air or something at the grounds to...
I think so, yeah. And I'm not entirely sure why. That's an animation I saw that it blew things out of the way. I wonder if that's so that it moves some of the larger bits out of the way of the surface so that it could maybe get a little depth.
Yeah, and it wants, of course, it wants the stuff to lift off the surface and go into its sampling container. Because you can't suck stuff up. Everything is in a vacuum, so you can't, when
yes,
you're in a vacuum, you can't suck anymore.
So
they do have to use ingenious methods. So the other probe that's done this recently is the Hayabusa 2 mission, which was it late last year, maybe beforehand, went to a different asteroid called Ryugu. Kind of similar size. These asteroids are a few hundred meters across, so they're pretty small in the grand scheme of things, in terms of asteroids we think of that you might be household names, which is possibly a bit of an overstatement, but Ceres and Vesta are hundreds of kilometers across. These things are 100 meters across. And they're both interesting that they've got a lot of rubble on them. They've got a lot of boulders all over the surface. Hayabusa went and it shot a projectile, a bullet, into the surface to create the cloud of material that it tried to collect. And then it brings that back to Earth. The advantage of actually going and visiting and taking your quick kit with you is that, in principle, you can do several experiments or you can do the same experiment in several places. So I know Hayabusa 2 had some landers it took with it that lowered down, and so in principle could take measurements at several places on the surface. This you can't do it, and you are a little bit limited in where you can land as well. So this had the boulders cause a problem, and we think it's bad enough trying to pick a place on Mars to land probes that's got a flat area. The photos of these asteroids, both Ryugu and Bennu that OSIRIS-REx has been to, as they're strewn with like rocks.
Yeah, it's so interesting how when you think about an asteroid, you tend to think of it as being like a potato with dents all over it, but mostly like a rough surface without extra stuff on it. But actually what we're finding is, and particularly this was quite interesting when Rosetta went to the comet 67P, you notice that actually there's rocks at all scales, really. And even the smooth bits have rocks on them.
Yeah, there's bumps on the bumps.
Yeah.
However much you zoom in. What OSIRIS-REx has been able to do at the asteroid is to take lots and lots of photos. It's taken lots of footage. It has got a few other experiments on board. So it's been able to establish maybe what the history of the asteroid is. And this is where asteroids are really useful, because a lot of them are basically primordial in terms of the solar system. They're often pretty old material, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they're things which haven't been turned into planets. They're things which haven't really done anything since they were dumped from, you know, well before the planets actually formed into planets.
Mm. There's some that are also blown apart. So there are hints that maybe Bennu used to be part of a larger object that had sort of hydrothermal processes, which means it could have been part of a larger object which had a big impact and got thrust off into space. And that's why it has all this, it has this rubble, rubbly nature. It's got lots of boulders together that imply that perhaps it's a collection of material that got blasted off and then did accumulate, but was not really massive enough to form a solid object like the moon or the Earth. So it is a rubble pile in that sense. So OSIRIS-REx, as you mentioned, is due to come back in 2023 at some point. There is this Hayabusa 2 probe, the Japanese spacecraft that went to this different asteroid Ryugu. It's due back later this year. So December this year, it's due to come back and deposit its samples through the atmosphere. When its predecessor mission Hayabusa came back, it had just collected a few little grains of asteroid material. It hadn't done very much. It hadn't got very much because it had all sorts of problems. So hopefully, fingers crossed, Hayabusa 2 will have a lot of material, and also OSIRIS-REx will have material as well. And the results, I'm sure, will take a while to come out as they're analysed, but it's a unique way of studying these asteroids and learning about the history of the formation of the solar system. So moving further afield, at the start of this year, there's a star that was in the news an awful lot. And it was a star that it goes by multiple names that are all spelt the same but pronounced differently. So I say Betelgeuse, you say
Betelgeuse.
There we go. Other people will say something in between, I'm sure. So this is the star that at the end of last year, it's one of the brightest stars in the sky, was dimming. And it suddenly dropped out of the top 50, I think, when it got to its minimum. And then it came back up again. There were all sorts of theories. Was it about to go supernova? Because it's an old star. It's a red giant star. It's nearing the end of its life. It now looks like that episode was due to dust in the atmosphere. So it's given off some, it chucked out some material. I think that was my understanding. Is that your understanding of those results as well?
So I think it was thermally pulsing. And when you, if you... I mean, it's a little bit counterintuitive that you think you've got this thing and it gets bigger. You'd think that would be the same amount of light. It's just spread over a larger area. But actually what happens is when a star does these pulsations, it gets bigger and actually the surface cools a bit. It's like pouring your cup of tea in your saucer. It cools down a little bit. And then when you pour it back into your cup of tea, it's cooler. But actually it doesn't matter with a star because it's got an engine in the middle, unlike your tea.
Yeah.
And so when it does this, it cools down and the brightness goes down. And when it gets smaller again, the brightness goes back up and this sort of thing. And actually you had another episode, which was the one related to the dust cloud. And so it's, yeah, that's why it's undergone these changes over the last year or so. And but the fact that it's done these pulsations has allowed people to model it very accurately, because the stars go through various different stages as they evolve. And Betelgeuse is an evolved star. It's not a young star. It's been around for quite a long time. It's lived most of its life, and it's ending. It's entering the final phase of its life, which we now think is going to be in about 100,000 years. And when it enters this final phase, this type of star will do this pulsation, and making those measurements of the pulsations allows us to fit it into what we know about other stars. And one of the outcomes of that is that we can now accurately quantify its size, which has been a little bit of a mystery up until now. And because we know its size, we know how big it is physically, we know how big it is on the sky, we can get an accurate distance measure to it.
So this is is it small and close, or is it big and far away?
Yep. That's right.
That's the distinction here that is trying to be worked out. Being one of the largest stars that we know about, that we know of, and not too distant, it's a few hundred light years away. Although now about the estimate is about 20% closer, I think, than it was last month. It is one that we can see, as you say, we can see resolved images. So we can see the disk of the star on the sky, which means we can estimate, or we can measure how big it appears in terms of an angle on the sky. Now that means it's slightly closer, so it's about 25% closer, I think. So it's only 530 light years away, still not close enough to go and visit, unfortunately. It's still not too close, because that is one of the worries with a star that's going to go supernova. I hope it's not too close. It's still at a safe distance, right?
Yeah, that's right. And also, well, it depends how it goes supernova as well. If it just went supernova and exploded in roughly the same way in all directions, then it's sufficiently far away not to pose much of a threat. If it beams, so if its magnetic field causes it to the explosion to come out of the poles, the top and the bottom, and it's facing towards us, then that could be an issue because all of the energy would then be, instead of concentrated all over, it would just be concentrated in a beam. It's unlikely to be that, but you know, you never know.
Yeah. So we're probably safe. It also means it's not quite as big as it was thought to be. So it was thought to be getting on for 1,000 times the mass, the size of our sun. So it would fill the orbit of Jupiter, I think, if it were in our solar system, which would obviously engulf the Earth as well. It's now only, is it 750 times the diameter of the sun?
Yeah, which is, that's right.
Yeah, it would only fill beyond the orbit of Mars. Yeah, it's still pretty big. So we still dwarf our sun. And this is as things slowly evolve. It is weird to think that this star is closer than we thought it was. You know, it sounds like something easy to measure the distance to things, but actually in astronomy, it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard to measure the distance. You either have to rely on the thing you're looking at moving with respect to things that are almost stationary. So, and that only works for things that are relatively close by. So things in our solar system, obviously you can see the planets and asteroids and comets moving. And some stars as well are close enough that you can see those stars moving when 6 months apart, when the Earth is on opposite sides of the sun. You have to take different measurements. That's called parallax. And you don't see those stars moving. The motion of those stars in space, you just see the apparent motion because they're closer to you. And some stars themselves are moving as well, and that's called proper motion. And you can measure that proper motion as well. But it is very, very difficult to measure these distances, and that's why astronomers have to be very tricky and find different ways of doing this and using things that are called standard candles, like type 1a supernovae, which we think have a maximum brightness.
It's an age-old problem of measuring distance to things, and it's not something that we're going to beat with technology either. It's not something where technology will get better and let us do it. I guess apart from maybe parallax, this, as you said, this apparent motion getting more sensitive and allows to stretch out to greater distances. But even that is going to have its limits sort of thought at some point. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we'll be able to do that. But at the moment, I think we can map something like 1% of the galaxy or something to some reasonable accuracy. So there we are, a star that is closer to us. Now let's move on even further, and let's go from stars to black holes. We talk about black holes an awful lot on this program, on this podcast. The black hole we'll talk about first is one that's relatively far away. It's a few hundred million or a couple of hundred million light years away. The question that I guess goes with this black hole discovery is, have you ever been spaghettified, Edward?
Yeah, no, not personally, no. So spaghettification is a really funny term, but it's what physicists call the process of falling into a black hole, because as you get closer and closer to a black hole, the pull of the black hole distorts the space around you as well as distorting you. So you get sort of stretched long and thin, not only because the back of you and the front of you are feeling a different pull, but also because the space around you is being warped by this incredibly compact object. And recently, astronomers have discovered something that was spaghettified as it fell into a supermassive black hole in the constellation of Eridanus. It caused what's called a tidal disruption event, which basically is a fancy way of saying a spaghettified thing, but it's something that was approaching the black hole that was tidally. Now we're quite familiar with tides from the Earth, that the moon causes the tides. In this case, it's not the pull of the moon, but it's the pull of a black hole pulling, and it disrupts the object, i.e. pulls it apart as it goes towards the centre of the spiral galaxy.
And this star, I think, was a star that's not unlike our sun in terms of its mass, and it lost a good chunk of its mass, the estimates are, to this black hole as it whizzed by and got presumably ripped apart. Do we know whether the star is still there? I mean, has it survived or has it got completely destroyed?
I don't think it's something that we can see. So what astronomers saw was a bright blip as this happened, because this galaxy is so far away, it's very difficult to resolve individual stars unless they're incredibly bright and something terrible happens to them, like a supernova explosion or that tidal disruption event happens and a star gets too close to the central black hole of the galaxy, as happened here. The black hole in the center did a burp. It did this powerful outflow of material after having spaghettified the remains of this star.
This is presumably going to be useful for studying these in the future as well, because these must be happening all the time, but we don't necessarily know how to recognize them all. Is that a problem we have?
It's very good, this one in particular, because it was caught early on. So that's always the key with something like this event, is in order to know what it is, it's not enough just to see it after it's happened. If you can see it while it's happening, then you stand a much better chance of piecing together the physics that's happening here. And this is true of just about every phenomenon in astronomy is catching, because we can't have any control over when these things happen. We rely on just being aware enough and awake enough to these things that as soon as something starts, you can switch a whole load of telescopes over to looking at it. And actually, that's something that my observatory was one of the observatories that was able to switch to looking at this phenomenon as it happened. That's the Las Cumbres Observatory, but many others, like the European Southern Observatory, also looked at it in a variety of wavelengths, which is really essential. You want to get a multi-messenger approach, as it's called now. I don't imagine there would be any gravitational waves coming from it, but you never know.
Well, though, I mean, the gravitational waves that come from these kind of events are much longer wavelength than the ones we can measure at the moment from the ground. And they are things that the LISA mission, which is planned for launch in a decade or so, will be able to pick up. So this is something where, again, we might get we might get a heads up that this is happening. We might not know exactly where it is from the gravitational waves, and then be able to start to turn our telescopes towards it when we know it's happening. So that will be an incredibly powerful tool in a decade or so when LISA is launched and is operational. But yes, at the moment that we're not able to detect that kind of event in gravitational waves. Now, we talk about black holes a lot, and they've been in the news as well this month. October is typically the month of Nobel Prizes. So these prizes that are awarded to the people that the Nobel Committee has decided are worthy of them in a bunch of fields, one of which is physics. And for the second year in a row, it's gone to astronomers and to black hole astronomers as well. Now, the Nobel Prize is often split up between astronomers, so it's worth around £1 million for getting on for £1 million, to put it in comparison. Half of that went to someone called Sir Roger Penrose, who's a very famous scientist who researched the theory of black holes. The other half was split again, and it went to two astronomers, Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez, who were involved in the observations around black holes. And so we can touch on these separately. There are all sorts of disputes about whether the Nobel Prize is appropriate, because it only goes to three people, and normally these are in vast teams of people who are actually doing this. With the theory side of this, with Sir Roger Penrose, he really was driving a lot of theory here. So that is kind of an individual achievement that is worth acknowledging. And his work in the middle of the 20th century was about the whether black holes were actually allowed, whether they were possible, right? And because mathematically, yes, you can have them. That was shown back at the start of the 20th century. But whether they are actually physically possible was something that he proved, right?
Or whether they were transient states, you know, whether they were things which just evaporated. Because although they are allowable by Einstein's general relativity, and there are a lot of things which are allowable, but in practice, whether they will actually exist is sort of a separate issue from whether they're allowable by the theory, because the theory doesn't say anything about the universe itself, and the universe and the theory is one of the laws of the universe, but it doesn't say anything about the fabric of the universe, the makeup of the universe. And the universe we live in is the type of universe we live in is actually still a little bit up for grabs, you know, exactly how the equations that you write to describe our universe. That's one of the really important things is knowing whether black holes could exist, whether there's some problem, whether they would destroy space-time or whether they would just boil away or whatever. So that's fundamental. And now we have actually been able to observe black holes, and really without that foresight, nobody would have been looking for this. That would have been really a fringe theory without this really solidification of this idea that a black hole, and I think originally they were called dark stars, were real things. There's actually a science fiction film called Dark Star, which is all about a black hole, but it's called Dark Star. I think it's from the 1960s.
And I think Penrose's revelation in some sense is that as the material collapses, if you get a star that collapses under its own gravity, because the nature of a black hole has this event horizon where nothing can escape, and actually where essentially time stops in some senses, that it does get frozen in that sense. So it doesn't then continue to evolve massively. You don't end up with, as you say, this transient event that appears and then disappears or evaporates or rips a hole in space-time or whatever. I mean, another example of things that you said, things that are mathematically possible but we don't think physically realizable, is wormholes. Wormholes are allowed by Einstein's theories of relativity. People like Stephen Hawking have talked about them. Lots of other people as well have talked about them before. But we don't think it is possible to form one in our universe. You can, you know, it just doesn't, wouldn't happen.
The biggest problem with a wormhole is keeping it open.
Right.
Wormholes are very interesting. They were predicted by a physicist called Flum back in the 1920s, and nobody really paid it much notice. He had a very non-sexy name for them. They were called paraboloids, and he just worked his way through the theory and just went, oh, this is an interesting solution for this. You know, an outcome of this theory is this paraboloid, this wormhole, and everyone ignored it until Einstein and Wheeler came back to it, I think, in the 70s. And Wheeler looked at it again and went, oh, yeah, these are entirely natural phenomena that could exist, but they will exist for a tiny fraction of a second and then disappear again because they just collapse. And so whether at that level nobody's really been able to do much more work on it, whether these things really do exist or whether they exist for so little time that they actually never exist, whether it's a real thing like Hawking radiation or whether it's just a peculiarity of the mathematics.
So Penrose was awarded the prize for his discoveries of a theoretical understanding of black holes and showing that they could exist. But showing that things could exist is very different to showing that things do exist. And that's actually what the other half of the prize was for. And these two astronomers, so this is one where they were big collaborations. So these two astronomers, Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez, were part of a collaboration that was studying the heart of our galaxy, where we now know there is a supermassive black hole that's millions of times the mass of our sun. But their work and the work of them and their team was central to understanding or to be able to figure out it was a black hole. And these are really hard measurements to make. The heart of our galaxy, the center of our galaxy, is not an easy place to observe, is it?
No, that's right. I mean, you're pointing towards the most densely populated part of the galaxy. So trying to get observations of anything in there. And also, if you're looking for how do you find something that's by its very nature is invisible in light? It's it's a supermassive black hole, so it is a phenomenally difficult thing to do. You have to study the dynamics, the effect that this supermassive black hole has on its surroundings, and sort of backtrack then, and then you have to support that with lots and lots of evidence that means that it could only be something that massive. And if you've got something that massive there, it has to occupy a very, very small space. Otherwise, it would be able to be seen and would be so large that that it would have, there would be other effects there.
The observations they made were using telescopes that looked in the infrared, or the near infrared at least, so just slightly longer wavelengths than we see with our eyes. And they made these amazing time-lapse images, essentially, of the stars, as you say, going around the black hole. And they were the big revelation, to be able to track these stars. But they have to then track these objects over decades. You're right, it's a difficult place to observe because of all the huge number of stars, the dust in the way, and so on, that you have to stare through. But those images, I mean, I've certainly used them in public talks before. I think there aren't many astronomers who've given public talks that have talked about black holes that haven't used those time-lapse images. This thing is 2 million times the mass of the solar system, and is, I think it's something, it's smaller than the orbit of Uranus or something. It's which on cosmic scales is absolutely
tiny.
Yeah. So those are the key discoveries. The other thing that is impressive, as well as being the second time in a row, and the third time in 4 years, and so on, that astronomy has been featured, which is good for astronomy. It is the fourth time in the history of the Nobel Prize, which is going for 100 odd years, that a woman has been awarded the Nobel Prize for physics. And given there have been something like 200 winners, that's not a record to be particularly proud of.
No, it's a really shocking record.
It's it's something that is slowly changing. I think most people would argue too slowly. Hopefully it will get better over time. So congratulations to those winners, and of course to all the people in the teams that they worked with to make those groundbreaking discoveries. We look forward to finding out whether astronomy wins the prize next year as well. See if we can make it 3 in 3 years. We shall see. Okay, so that's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, and you can now search for us on Spotify. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, from me and Edward, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.